The most famous verse in Hosea chapter 8 is the seventh verse, which speaks about sowing the wind and reaping the whirlwind. Interestingly enough, that verse has been picked out by quite a number of secular people, and it has been the basis of several secular films in the world of the cinema. And these films have been about people reaping not only what they have sown, but more than they have sown. Some of these films are, for example, Reap the Wild Wind. If you remember that, John Wayne. The Grapes of Wrath was another one. Random Harvest was another one. Bitter Harvest was another one. And that's a selection of some of the films that have been based on Hosea chapter 8 and verse 7, sowing the wind and reaping the whirlwind. And it has also been the basis of many fine Christian hymns. There's an old Sankey one going through my head. You'll reap whatsoever you sow. The harvest is certainly coming. You reap whatsoever you sow. Sowing the wind and reaping the whirlwind. And the general principle of the verse seems to be that the harvest that you reap is always greater than the harvest that you sowed. For example, a farmer who plants 100 potatoes in the spring doesn't expect to reap 100 potatoes in the autumn. He expects a harvest, a multiple crop. He expects that the 100 potatoes have turned into something else. In the same way, if the farmer sows barley in a field, when the harvest comes, he doesn't expect to reap exactly the same number of seeds that he sowed. He expects a harvest from the seed, 30-fold, 60-fold, and 100-fold. And according to Hosea chapter 8 and verse 7, and indeed according to the teaching of Christ, 8 centuries later, that's a principle that holds in the world of behavior. If we sow in our lives joy and love and peace and grace and blessing for others, at the end of the day, we shall reap a multiple harvest. Not simply what we've sown, but a multiple harvest. And in the same way, if we go around sowing bitterness and anger and jealousy and malice towards others, the same principle holds true. At the end of the road, we shall reap a multiple harvest, because we always harvest more than we sow. We sow the wind and we reap the whirlwind. That is the chapter's most famous verse. But Hosea starts with something equally as famous, and I want to work through the chapter from that something. It's the idea of the covenant between man and God in verse 1. If you look at verse 1, you'll see that God complains there in the middle of the verse, they have broken my covenant. And once you grasp this idea of the covenant between God and man as the real start of what Hosea is saying in this chapter, then I think you've mastered a pattern of truth that runs throughout the chapter. And here is how it runs. You start with the covenant in verse 1, they've broken my covenant, and you see this covenant expressed as law. at the end of verse 1. They've broken my law, they've broken my covenant, and transgressed my law. And then Hosea takes the idea of law and laws and shows what men can do with them. In verse 1, they're transgressing the law. In verse 12, they're regarding the law of God as a strange thing. And then he narrows the laws down to one particular law about Israel not having any king other than God. That's in verse 4. They made kings, but not through me. They set up princes, but without my knowledge. And then he reaches the climax of the chapter, which is sowing the wind and reaping the whirlwind. And I think that that is a pattern of truth there. It's a kind of expansion and contraction motif. From the idea of covenant, he expands into laws and what men can do with the laws of God. And then he narrows the laws down to one, Israel choosing a king against the command of God. And then from that one disobedience, he moves on to sowing the wind and reaping the whirlwind. I think that's the pattern of truth. So let's start with the covenant in verse 1. They have broken my covenant. Now, further back, there's also a reference to the covenant in chapter 6 and verse 7. The same kind of complaint, chapter 6 and verse 7, God says, like Adam, they transgressed the covenant. And the idea is this, that when God made Adam, he entered into a covenant with him. The teaching of the Westminster Confession of Faith is that God deals with men through covenants. He makes bargains with men and agreements with men. And when Adam was created, God entered into a covenant with man. And some Christians have seen from the creation of Adam a covenant of works in the garden. This do, and thou shalt live, said God. You can do what you like in the garden, but do not eat the fruit of the tree of the knowledge of good and of evil. And some Christians have believed that that, in fact, is a covenant of works. Do not eat the fruit of the tree of the knowledge of good and of evil. But I believe you've got to see beyond that law and that prohibition in the garden, and it was the only prohibition in the garden. You've got to see beyond that law God's covenant with Adam. Was not a covenant of works. It was a covenant of grace. The whole Garden of Eden was an incarnation of the grace of God. Absolutely everything that man needed was there in the garden for his asking and for his taking. Adam had safety, he had security, he had food and water, he had human love, he had companionship, he had lordship over the beasts, and he had a day's work to do. Absolutely everything that man needed or could conceivably want was there in the garden. And so the whole scenario of the Garden of Eden is a scenario that is shot through with the grace of God. And everything there in the garden was the provision of grace and an expression of the covenant of grace. And that one law prohibiting Adam from eating the fruit of that tree, that one prohibition was also part of God's covenant of grace. God said, don't eat the fruit, or you will certainly die. And it was to save man from dying, from natural death and eternal death and spiritual death. It was to save man from dying that God said, don't eat the fruit. You see, the law, the prohibition, was an expression of God's love and care for Adam. You see, law is an expression of the love of God. If you are a parent watching a child growing up, you may say to the child as he goes near the electric fire, don't touch those bars, that's dangerous, you'll hurt yourself. Now, you don't tell your child to stay away from the fire because you dislike your child. You don't say, don't touch, because you don't care for your child. You say that because you love your child. And the prohibition is an expression of your love and your tenderness and your care for the child. And exactly the same way, the law of God, including the prohibitions in it, and it's not all prohibitions, it's not all negative, there's a lot of positive things in the law of God, but the prohibitions are expressions of the love of God and the covenant of grace. And I'm sure that this is the proper way to understand the covenant of grace in the Bible. There's a pattern, you know, in the covenant. This is how the covenant runs. God says, I am. I am. I love you. I choose you. I select you. I care for you. I will protect you. I will bring you into a goodly land and a great heritage, and I will multiply you. I am, I will, and then you shall. That's how the covenant runs. I am, I will, you shall. You see, the law of God is not a way of life. It's not even a means to life. You don't reach life by law. You don't live by law. Law is simply an expression of how covenant people live. People whose lives have been touched by the love of God and the covenant grace of God. People who have been brought into God's covenant of grace through Jesus Christ live like this. This is how they should live. In practical terms, sometimes the old Scots Puritan preachers used to say that to be a Christian is to be enlawed to God through Christ. People who have been touched with the saving grace of Christ are people who keep the law of God. You see, a lawless Christian is a contradiction in terms. You can't be a Christian and lawless. Because if you are Christian, you are saved into a law-abiding Christ. Like Adam, says God in chapter 6 and verse 7, like Adam, they've transgressed the covenant by going against the law. Chapter 8 and verse 1, they have broken my covenant by becoming lawless people. And I think that although that's perhaps rather an obvious lesson, It's a lesson that every generation needs to learn. I was hearing only recently about some young evangelical Christians in university who seem to think now that there's really nothing much wrong with experimental marriages. In other words, living together as husband and wife before they marry officially. And the reasons that they give, and these people call themselves evangelical Christians, this is not a fairy story, this is true. The reasons they give are, well, it's really all right as long as we love one another. And we're both Christians, and we're going to get married someday, and in any case, we've prayed about it. Well, how can you pray about something that is wrong? Do you need to pray and ask God for guidance in the matter of something that has already been forbidden in the law of God? Excuse my frankness. Fornication is still fornication. And sexual adventures outside the bonds of marriage are still fornication according to the Bible, whatever the permissive society says. And I am bound to say that the permissive society is a poor advert for permissive morality. You do not get the impression nowadays, do you, that men and women are happier with their permissiveness? To be a Christian is to be enlawed to God through Jesus Christ. We are saved into a Christ who keeps the law, and his law is an expression of his love for us. It is an expression of covenant grace, and it is how covenant Christians ought to live. They have broken my law. And then Hosea expands on that. Because if the covenant is expressed in laws, there are, of course, different things that you can do with law. For example, if you look at the verse, look at the end of verse 1, you read about the transgression of the law. But in fact, that stands as the second in a series of three. Because if you turn back to chapter 4 and verse 6, the verse that starts, "My people are destroyed for lack of knowledge," in the middle of that verse, you read about forgetting the law of God. Forgetting the law, chapter 4 and verse 6, chapter 8 and verse 1, transgressing the law, and then chapter 8 and verse 12, looking on God's law as a strange thing. Were I to write for him my laws by 10,000s, they would be regarded as a strange thing. And that's the sequence, Christian friends. Forgetting the law of God, transgressing the law of God, and then regarding the law of God as a strange thing. And I put it to you, I wonder if we have not reached this stage as a nation and as a society.
It's very easy to forget law, isn't it? If you're driving a car, you come to the crossroads, and momentarily, you forget the law. You make a mistake at the crossroads. You've done the wrong thing because the law slipped from your mind just for a second. I made just such a mistake when I was on the motorways down in England last week. There's a blind spot in this new car. It's your car. It's a lovely car. But there is a blind spot in it. And it lies between the rear view mirror and the side mirror. You see, the rear view mirror gives you a very good picture of the traffic coming behind you. And the side mirror gives you a pretty good picture of the traffic at the side. But between the area covered by the rear view mirror and the side mirror, there's a blind spot. And it so happened that on one occasion I moved out gently to overtake, and this fast red car whooshed past me at 80 or 90 miles an hour. He didn't show up in that mirror, and he didn't show up in this mirror, because in fact he was in the blind spot. And for a moment, I forgot the law. I should have followed the law, which is that it's safest always to look round just to make sure that there's nobody there. That's the safe way. But the law slipped my mind. And so it's easy to forget laws. Of course, if there's no other traffic there at the crossroads, no harm is done. And we all make minor mistakes, and hopefully we'll learn by our minor mistakes. We'll learn from our follies when we forget the law of God. But it's one thing to forget the law, and it's another thing to transgress the law. Because to transgress the law has in it deliberation. There's something intentional in it. There's daring in it. You're trying to challenge God when you transgress the law. I think you know that the word trans means across, transatlantic, transcontinental, trans-European, transfer, transpose. And to transgress is to wander and to stray and to go beyond and to exceed. It's one thing to forget the laws of God, but it's another thing to challenge them and to go beyond them. I like to think of a set of fences, and God builds the fences, and he says, now, if you want to be safe, if you want food, if you want wisdom, if you want water, stay inside the fences. Because outside the fences, you'll find danger and wolves and wilderness. And to transgress the law is to cross the fences and go into the dangers and the wolves and the wilderness. And again, it's one thing to transgress the law, and it's another thing to consider the law of God a strange thing. In verse 12, were I to write for him my laws by 10,000s, they would be regarded as a strange thing. And it seems that that's the point that we've reached in our society. Men and women now consider the laws of God quaint, their oddities. Strange, naive. Have you never had it said to you, "Deary me, you surely don't believe that antiquated nonsense in this day and age?" Well, what the day and age have to do with it, I don't know. Truth is truth, whatever the day and age. And true truth is as true today as it was in Jesus' day or in Moses' day. Changeless truth is changeless truth, and the day and age have nothing to do with it. The earth revolves round its axis. That's true, and it's true forever. Until the world ends, or something goes wrong. If you touch a red-hot poker, you will burn yourself. That's true. It was true for Moses. And it's true today. If you throw an apple into the air, it will come down again. In this world, at a certain rate. In other worlds, at different rates. But if you throw it up, it will come down. That was true for Moses. And it's true today. You see, the laws of God on marriage and on adultery and honesty and personal integrity and chastity and truthfulness are now regarded as oddities and quaint museum pieces. And that's the third stage. Stage one is forgetting it. Stage two is transgressing it. And stage three is looking upon it as something that is quaint. Were I to write for him my laws by 10,000s, they would be regarded as a strange thing. And then out of the laws and the way that men react to them, Hosea homes in on one major special law that Israel had broken. In verse 4, you see, when Israel came out of Egypt, she was a commonwealth under God. She was ruled by God, first of all through elders, the 70 elders who helped Moses, and then later on in the next generation, she was ruled by judges, Samson, Jephthah, and Deborah, if you please. The trouble was that all the nations round about were not commonwealths. They were kingdoms. Israel was a theocracy, a nation under God. But everybody else had a king. And so Israel wanted a king. And God said, "No, no, no. If you take a king, it'll be the end of you. I'm your king. You don't need a king. You've got a king. I'm your king." Said, "We want a king because we want to be like all the nations round about us," which was hardly why God had chosen them in the first place. Oh, it's a great story, this major mistake in 1 Samuel chapter 8. Let's just read it as we move towards the end. Samuel, you see, he's getting on in years. And he was very indiscreet. He couldn't rule his household, and his children were out of control. And very foolishly, he did what he shouldn't have done. He put them into the ministry. Two unworthy fellows put them into the ministry. When Samuel became old, 1 Samuel 8, chapter 8 and verse 1, he made his sons judges over Israel. The name of his firstborn was Joel, the name of the second Abijah. They were judges in Beersheba, yet his sons did not walk in his ways, but turned aside after gain. They took bribes and perverted justice. Then all the elders of Israel gathered together, came to Samuel at Ramah, where he lived, said to him, "Behold, you are old, and your sons do not walk in your ways. Now appoint for us a king to govern us, like all the nations." These burning words, the downfall of Israel for the next 200 years, and the cause of the Babylonian captivity. It was this that brought the Jews to Babylon, like all the nations. But the thing displeased Samuel when they said, "Give us a king to govern us." And Samuel prayed to the Lord. And the Lord said to Samuel, "Hearken to the voice of the people in all that they say to you, for they have not rejected you, but they have rejected me from being king over them." It was the theocracy that they'd rejected. "According to all the deeds which they've done to me, from the day I brought them up out of Egypt, even to this day, forsaking me and serving other gods, so they're doing to you. Don't be afraid, Samuel. Now then, hearken to their voice. Only you must solemnly warn them and show them the ways of this king who shall reign over them." So Samuel told all the words of the Lord to the people who were asking a king from him. He said, "These will be the ways of the king who will reign over you. He will take your sons and appoint them to his chariots and to be his horsemen, and to run before his chariots." There'll be compulsory conscription. They'll have to serve in the army. "He will appoint for himself commanders of thousands, commanders of fifties, some to plow his ground and to reap his harvest and to make his instruments, his implements of war and the equipment for his chariots. He will take your daughters to be perfumers and cooks and bakers. He will take the best of your fields and vineyards and olive orchards and give them to his servants. He will take the tenth of your grain and of your vineyards and give it to his officers and to his servants. He will take your men servants and maid servants and the best of your cattle and your asses and put them to his work. He will take the tenth of your flocks, and you shall be his slaves. And in that day you will cry out because of your king whom you've chosen for yourselves. But the Lord will not answer you in that day." But the people refused to listen to the voice of Samuel. Oh, my friends! Conforming to the world has been the death of God's work in every generation. Wanting to be like the nations, like everybody else, like the people, you adopt their standards, their living standards, their morals, the way they spend their money. Conformity to the world. It's been the death of the work of Christ in every generation. We want a king to be like everybody else. It's fatal. You see, Christians are at their best when they're not like the world. The people refused to listen to the voice of Samuel. They said, "No, but we will have a king over us, that we also may be like all the nations." And so here in Hosea 8 and 4, they made kings, but not through me. They set up princes, but without my knowledge. And if you turn over to the 13th chapter, he picks up that same theme again in verses 10 and 11. Chapter 13, verses 10 and 11. "Where now is your king to save you? And where are all your princes to defend you, those of whom you said, give me a king and princes. I have given you kings in my anger, and I have taken them away in my wrath. And it's interesting, and lots of the Christian commentators point this out, that after the 70 years captivity in Babylon, and it was the monarchy that drove them to it, it's interesting that when the Jews came back to Palestine, they never again had a king. The royal line was still there, running through Zerubbabel, the prince. He never became king. Right down to a princess called Mary, and a prince of the royal house called Joseph, and of Mary was born the King of the Jews. But from the end of the monarchy till the coming of Jesus Christ, there was never a king in Israel, because they learned their lesson. In fact, the King of the Jews died on his cross with that above his head. Jesus of Nazareth, the King of the Jews. And when the Jews said to Pilate, take that down, Pilate said, did he know a thing or two? Had he insight? What I have written, I have written. The law of God said, no king but God. Just as our law is, no king but Jesus. And Israel said, no, we want kings to be like everybody else. So God gave them kings. And the climax was verse 7, sowing the wind and reaping the whirlwind. And on the grounds, as I said earlier on, that we reap not only what we sow, but more than we sow, I think this verse is a very timely kind of warning. Now, just let me speak kindly here. I sometimes get a bit disturbed when I look at some Christians and see how little their religion seems to amount to, and how little their religion seems to cost them. One of the things I've noticed recently is the awful slowness in our fellowship to respond to invitations and challenges. Ian Shankland has been appealing for years for help in the tape ministry, and although pleas have been put out time and time again, no one comes forward. The Women's Guild is constantly appealing for more members, and no one comes forward. The Young Women's Group could be doing with more numbers. Invitations are handed out. Please go out. There's a good syllabus. And there's this awful slowness to respond. The appeal to that large congregation this morning for help to take the patients to the services. Three names from that vast congregation. The appeal this morning for people to go to the missionary seminar in the YMCA. Not one single name from that big congregation. And I think I must say this most kindly of all. The attendance at our fellowship's prayer gathering is nothing less than shameful. You know, we are known in this town as an evangelical congregation. And we are known in Scotland as an evangelical congregation. Where do you think the visitors come from during the summer months? And through the tape ministry, we are known all over the place as an evangelical congregation. And people who are on holiday from San Diego and California and Canada will pop into prayer fellowship on a Saturday evening and they say, "My goodness, where are all your Christians?" Slow to respond. I have the greatest sympathy for people who are shy and who are tender in spirit and tender in heart and reticent and like to take back seats. But it would be awful to think, you know, that our religion was organized according to convenience. It would be awful to think that certain things are excluded from our lives just because they are inconvenient, because they interrupt our pleasures or our time or our hobbies or our evenings or our family life or our marriage. Since when was the kingdom of God ever built on those who had a religion of convenience? Since when was the work of Christ, I mean, the ongoing permanent work of Christ that goes on when we die, when was that ever built on people whose religion was just an affair of convenience? Is there anyone here who has been cooling off? You know, I do notice that there are evangelical Christians whose religious performance now is one appearance in God's house on God's day. Cooling off, careless, lackadaisical, the edge gone, edge. Cutting edge. Hosea says, "Be careful. Oh, be careful." It's Hosea's last word to us in this chapter, to the preacher included. Oh, be careful. Be careful. Sow the wind and you reap the whirlwind. Amen. May God add a blessing to his own holy word. To his name be the honor and the praise. Glory to thee, my God, this night for all the blessings of the light. Keep me, O keep me, King of Kings, beneath thy own almighty wings. 561.